Okay, so the talk for today is actually, it was posed as a question. What is the basis of oppression, oppressive ideas, racism, sexism, and homophobia? Is it bigoted attitudes or the structure of society? And I think that the argument that oppression is grounded in the structure of society and isn't just based on people's bigoted ideas can seem pretty counterintuitive to people. Because most people's experience of oppression comes from, you know, other workers or, you know, their peers in their lives. Women, for example, if we just take that example, will experience sexism from the men as well as the women in our lives. So, you know, for instance, every time it's expected that we'll play a particular role or do a particular chore, you know, because we're women. And there are countless other examples. For instance, schools are some of the most closed communities. You know, you can't get into a school unless you work there. Yet studies consistently show that schools are the least safe places for young gays and lesbians. And almost always the first thing that will come to mind when we think about, you know, racism, for instance, is racist attitudes and comments like, go back to where you belong, directed towards, you know, Muslims or Arabs, for instance. But contrary to the surface appearance of things, it isn't bigoted individuals who cause sexism and homophobia. And in this talk, I will argue that it's actually the structure of capitalist society that gives rise to it. This is a controversial point. I want to mark that out pretty early on in my talk. A society based around the minority rule of the capitalist class and the exploitation of the majority of people in society, the society of capitalism in which we live, is consequently a society that requires oppression to buttress that rule of the minority. And this doesn't mean, for instance, that we deny, as socialists, that workers can hold backwards or bigoted attitudes. That is clearly the case. But these are a reflection of the structural oppression that is absolutely central to capitalism and not the cause. And understanding the basis for oppression is no small thing. It really matters because if you know the cause of something, then I think that puts you in the best position to fight it. And I was sort of thinking of a way of explaining this. It's a bit lame, but what I could come up with is it's kind of like that those TV shows about medical problem-solving teams, like House, for instance, that, you know, they can't really treat the symptoms of an illness that they don't know the origins of. And if they try, at best, they'll be less effective, or at worst, they'll make really disastrous mistakes, you know, cutting off someone's leg or whatever. And, you know, they'll actually miss opportunities to get rid of that illness. Socialists want to rid society of the malaise of oppression, which does kill people, we should be clear, because it's a fact that young queer people commit suicide at much higher rates than straight youths. That, you know, women are ground down, that our lives and choices are limited by the gender stereotypes and expectations that will play particular roles in society, by the material reality that we're paid less at work, that we're forced to be economically dependent on others, and so on. Aboriginal deaths in police custody, also a fact. Drastically lower mortality rates for Aboriginals versus whites in Australia, also a fact of this system. And we can't be effective in the fight to get rid of all of this oppression unless we're clear about where bigoted attitudes actually come from. So my starting point then is this system of capitalism. Capitalism is a class society. That doesn't just mean in the narrowest terms that there are rich and poor or there are haves and have-nots. I mean, that's clearly the case, isn't it? But rather, it's that the people with wealth and privilege in capitalism have gotten their wealth through the exploitation of the vast majority of people. All systems of class rule that have existed throughout history have required oppression. And this really makes sense because how else could a minority maintain their power and a situation of mass inequality for everyone else if it wasn't through trying to use some way of maintaining that? Exploitation is the hallmark of this particular class system of capitalism. Profits, which power the system, would not exist if the bosses did not steal the labour of workers. And, you know, that is that they pay us much less in wages than the value that our work actually creates for them. And further to that, workers are actually economically coerced into selling our labour. If we don't work, it's pretty simple. We don't eat, we can't pay our rent or our mortgages. Capitalism is a little different, however, to other class systems that have existed before it, like feudalism, in which the lower class was simply the property of the lord. These sorts of systems actually tended to rely much more on just brute force to support the rule of the minority. But the illusion that was sort of surrounded the rise of capitalism, that this system was somehow freer or fairer or more equal than other class systems, is actually just an illusion. And it's an illusion that actually has been laid bare many times, especially in situations where the capitalist class have faced a challenge to their rule. then they have been more than prepared to resort, you know, to violence, to throw off their veneer of democracy, to hold up their rule. And certainly capitalism has thrived under military dictatorships in many places around the world, like in Chile under Pinochet from the 70s, or Burma today is another example of a military dictatorship. But the capitalists, and especially in the liberal democracies, don't rule primarily by force. Key to maintaining social order and enforcing acceptance and compliance with the status quo is the extensive ideological apparatus that propagates the ideas that actually hold up capitalism. And what is this apparatus? It's institutions, but it's also idea-peddling individuals like, you know, liberal journalists, the academia of the idea factories, the universities, the mass education system more broadly, political parties, the church and the family. These institutions and individuals act as little transmitters, or, well, they're not really little, are they? They're kind of very big satellite dishes sort of pumping out and spreading pro-capitalist ideas. And this is nothing new, really. Marx and Engels wrote in their German Ideology of 1845 that the ideas of the ruling class are in every epoch the ruling ideas. So what are the ruling ideas of capitalism then? Some of these will be self-evident, but that competition, or that war, according to Obama's peace price acceptance speech, and racism are products of human nature. That women have always been subordinate to men, that we're just naturally more nurturing and therefore best fitted for the role of childcare. And importantly, that revolutions always end in tyranny and dictatorship. All of the ideas that put the blame for society's ills on ordinary people, not the way capitalism is structured. And ideas which assert that any struggle to get rid of things, to get rid of the rule of the minority, will always end in something worse. So why even bother? But underneath all of this ideology, all the high school textbooks and the age editorials, lies the reality that capitalism, with all of its rhetoric of democracy, liberty and equality, is actually just about liberty and opportunity for the capitalist class. Not all of society, definitely not blacks or women, whose oppression was central to establishing capitalism and is still a key feature of upholding that system today. So I'm going to go through with my talk and use some examples to prove that oppression was not only structured into capitalism from its inception, but that it's used today as a way of upholding that system. And I want to point out here that I don't have time to look at all of the different oppressed groups in society. It was a hard enough task looking at racism, sexism and homophobia and getting through those in any meaningful way. But to say something briefly, all workers are oppressed as well as exploited in capitalism. We have different lives, horizons, living conditions, and standards of healthcare, even the kinds of schools that working class children go to as opposed to people from ruling class families, vastly different levels of opportunity and so on. Of course, there are sections of the working class that are also specifically oppressed in capitalism, as well as gays and lesbians, disabled people and the elderly, pensioners, experience oppression, which stems from the fact that they're not viewed as productive under capitalism and therefore are expendable. They're, you know, considered a drain on society, not something that's going to actually contribute to making profits. Children are also oppressed, considered the property of their parents pretty much. Their whole experience is of having to submit to the authority of the adults in their lives, at home, at school, under their teachers, as they're prepared by these institutions to accept the authority that's going to rule their lives in this system. There's a direct link between a profit-driven system and racism. And to see this, I want to look at an example that is a little something that we don't often look at, but is actually the history of this country, Australia. A colonial settler state established in 1788 as an outpost for British Empire and on stolen Aboriginal land. Australian capitalism was founded on genocide and dispossession of Aboriginal people, backed up and legitimised from the beginning by gross racism. And also the, you know, paternalistic ideas that, you know, white settlers and missionaries could play a role in civilising the native population. When the white settlers arrived in Australia, though, they found that they'd invaded a world very different to their own. Aboriginal people lived in relative harmony with the land. Collective social relations were expressed via relationship to land and key sites, but these ties weren't thought of in terms of ownership, or you think of, like, the way private property works under capitalism. People's lives weren't determined by the constant drive of capitalism for the bosses to accumulate more and more wealth. in competition with each other. So mostly in these societies, when people had to do work, they did enough work that, you know, that they could live from the products of that labour, and actually then just turned to doing other things that they found just as important as working, social activities or ritual. Aboriginal society was egalitarian. So the whole idea that some people in a society should dominate and exploit others really struck them as very irrational and horrific when they actually started to encounter it. And, for example, a book on early settlement by Jonathan King contains the journal entries of a settler who recounted an Aboriginal man's, his name was Arbruz, response to being made to watch some convicts being flogged by order of the governor, Arthur Phillip. The convicts were being punished because they had attacked some Aborigines, and Arbruz was made to attend and had the matter explained to him. And the whole point of it was to try and, you know, socialise this man into acceptance, into, you know, a law and order system that was being imposed, you know, to see that the state that was being imposed by white settlement could have some beneficial, role and so on, assimilate people into white concepts of law. So he went along, and when he watched the flogging, despite this intention of the governor, which was, you know, meant to be like gratitude from this Aboriginal man, he displayed on this occasion symptoms of disgust and terror only, is what the chronicler writes. He was repulsed by the Europeans' cruelty towards members of their own lower classes. And, of course, it was the case that white free settlers who killed Indigenous people as they seized Australian Aboriginal land actually received no such punishments. And in another example of the vast differences between Aboriginal society and European capitalism, a Victorian clergyman wrote at the time that it was difficult to get into a black fellow's head that one man is higher than another. And he was commenting on the fact that if one Aboriginal labourer was paid more for being more efficient, they wouldn't just hold on to that. They would immediately share that out with their kin and, social groups. From the 1820s, the development of the pastoral industry saw Australian capitalism actually expand very rapidly. And this required a systematic and brutal strategy for stealing Aboriginal land. Settlers were armed and were given authority by the governor to just shoot blacks on sight if they resisted the takeover of land. And, of course, there was resistance from Indigenous people, something that's largely hidden, written out of, history. But this resistance was brutally crushed. Not only were Indigenous people murdered, but forced to submit themselves to the mission system, whereby Christian missionaries assimilated blacks into capitalist society by severing their connections with land, denying them the right to speak in their own languages, and basically wiping out Aboriginal culture. And, you know, promoting all of the attendant racist ideas that blacks needed to be civilised, lifted from idleness, and made industrious and useful members of society. Land theft, denigration, and destruction of culture was necessary to impose a new hierarchical structure on society, because private property, wage labour, and the drive to accumulate capital, which were all fundamental to capitalism, was totally incompatible with Aboriginal society. So, what's the importance of this? Anti-Aboriginal racism was absolutely structured into Australian society. And the racism that justified that dispossession remains important for Australian capitalism today, and actually flows through to all of the institutions in this society. And the first form of racism in Australia was also useful for Australia's rulers in that it helped to draw up the ground rules for how society would be conducted. Once racism towards one section of society was entrenched, it was established that a group of people or race could be singled out for special treatment in this country, that they could be paid lower wages, or in the case of Aboriginal people, actually, they had their wages stolen for decades and received no pay, that they could be made subject to rigid government control and demonised in the media and other public forums. In other words, racism wasn't just about creating a set of ideas or attitudes. It was actually structured into these institutions. And one clear example of this is the police force. The material reality of race oppression means that black people are more likely to be arrested and jailed for minor offences in Australia. They're more likely to be killed when they're held in custody by the cops. And the violence that the cops use against blacks is reinforced by the fact that cops assume that they'll be held less responsible than they would be for their such equal treatment of whites. Because they are. Just look at, Chris Hurley, who killed Aboriginal man Doomadgee on Palm Island a couple of years ago while that man was in police custody. Actually, this police officer got a promotion for his tidy work, this brutal act of murder. Because the whole point of the police force is to enforce the property rights of the ruling class by harassing most of us who don't have those rights, the working class, picking on the most vulnerable sections of Australian society, like immigrants or Aboriginal people flows naturally and is all in a day's work. And the oppression of Australia's Indigenous population was easily transferred to other ethnic groups, immigrants and refugees, for instance, which brings me to the other ways oppression is useful to capitalism. In today's Australia, we're constantly being told that our biggest threat or problem, is refugees or illegals, who we apparently have no room for, who will drive down our wages and just want a free ride and so on. Refuse to integrate themselves into Australian society. Think of all of the bloody, headlines in the Age and so on. And this racism links back to a whole chain of immigrants from different backgrounds. When I was growing up during the 80s in Australia, it was actually Vietnamese immigrants who would supposedly take our jobs and refuse to assimilate and so on. And this shows the continued usefulness of racism for Australian capitalism, because the whole point of this is to encourage workers to vent their frustrations, not on the bosses, not on big business, but on victims of capitalism who seem even more weaker and vulnerable than ourselves. If the government can establish racist attitudes towards foreigners, then they can create scapegoats and deflect attention from the real problem in society. Not immigrants, but governments that refuse to fund public housing and welfare while they pump billions of dollars into brutal wars like the war and occupation of Afghanistan, who want to get away, the bosses, who want to get away with paying their employees slave wages, cutting back our ability to organise at workplace in our unions and smash our conditions. And of course, it's also very useful for our rulers if all of, if their targets are constantly vilified and attacked in the media as terrorists and so on. If they're segregated and isolated in ethnic ghettos, suburbs like, Footscray in Melbourne, for people who are from Melbourne, but these places are all around, Australia. In concentration camps, if you're a refugee, and preferably nowhere near mainland Australia, so that the, state can keep perpetuating the stereotypes. And it's for this reason that you can't separate out oppression from class exploitation, the thing that lies at the very heart of this system. Oppression is a critical tool that the ruling class have to ensure the stability of their system. It's about dividing and ruling. And so some people might say, and I was thinking about this when I was writing the talk, and it sort of comes up in conversations that I have with people who are interested in our politics all the time, doesn't this just sound a little conspiratorial or far-fetched? Is it really the case that governments and capitalists have planned this all out, whatever? So I guess to answer that, well, it's not quite the case that just every morning, the cabinet gets together and decides how they're going to use these ideas or whatever to screw Aboriginal people out of their land and so on. But the reality is that these racist ideas are grounded firmly in the logic of capitalist rule. So they do flow through to society. Mining rights for corporations can't coexist against collective ownership of land by Indigenous people. So today, that means keeping Australian capitalism profitable goes with government takeovers of Aboriginal land like the Northern Territory intervention. And it means Aboriginal people being forced to lease their land for the use of, corporations for toxic waste dumps and so on. And it's also about a justice system that instead of actually saying, well, this is gross injustice, actually backs up that state of affairs. But I guess the other way to answer that question on the other side of it is that actually governments do have a long history of fostering divisive ideas like racism to legitimise their political agendas. And an example of that we should all probably be quite familiar with is that of the War on Terror. Because think of what it required to actually, create all of the ideology around the War on Terror. Countless hours put into writing university courses on terrorism studies, not to mention the anti-terror laws themselves, the creation of government anti-terrorism task squads, the manufacturing of all the stereotypes that have just become, common in the media about Muslim men beating their wives and so on. And, of course, the jailing of the requisite number of Australian-grown terrorists like Jack Thomas or David Hicks or the Barwon 13 just to prove that the money was all well spent. And why did they do this? Well, it was to justify a government agenda of support for US imperialism and wars in the Middle East, which actually people in Australia opposed, and that's why they needed to do this. And it's also the case that bosses do know how to shore up their system. They're not just totally ignorant. And they know that a divided working class can only be an asset to them. So they do deliberately foster division between workers. And one example of this is a historical example that I want to give of the Ford Broadmeadows factory in the 1970s, in a suburb of Melbourne, Broadmeadows is. With a workforce comprised of 75% workers from non-English speaking backgrounds, management actually exploited the language barriers and ethnic divisions between workers there, between Greek, Italian and Turkish workers, just to name a few of the groups, purposefully constructing a production line where no workers with a common language work next to each other. And they also deliberately placed workers from backgrounds with a history of ethnic conflict together. And that's a real case in point. In the words of a Ford spokesman at the time, this was actually about an official policy of Ford. And the way he describes it makes it sound very benign, but also shows that it was a policy. He said, well, it's our procedure not to create ghettos. We try to mix them so that each section represents the workforce as a whole to get them used to a multicultural society. But bullshit, because actually that policy was designed to make it harder for workers to coordinate industrial action and fight against the horrendous conditions that they were confronted with from the management at Ford, where, you know, workers had to actually beg their foremen to be able to go to the toilet and have a toilet break. This is not made up. This is absolutely the case, where actually they were subject to massive work speed-ups from the bosses and so on. But it's clearly not just blacks and immigrants who suffer oppression in capitalism. Sexism and homophobia also help bolster the ruling class. Once the ruling class have established a history of targeting victims, it's very easy for them to slide into targeting other groups for society's ills or problems. For example, if we take divisions between men and women, well, these have existed before capitalism, but this system has actually moulded them and used them specifically to justify capitalist rule and to back it up. The nuclear family has been a central institution in capitalism, ensuring all of the work that goes into raising and training the next layer of workers is privatised within the home. And it's ensured the bosses, therefore, with a steady supply of workers to exploit free of charge. And, you know, who do they expect is going to actually largely play the role of doing this work? Well, it has been women in the home. And maintaining the centrality of the nuclear family has actually involved mass state intervention into women's lives. Historically, women's sexuality had to be repressed so as to force them to accept the restrictions of monogamy and their subservient role in the household. And, you know, although it is since the, you know, middle of the 20th century, it's not been the case that the role that women play in the home has been a central role for women in society. Actually, a majority of women, 70%, are part of the workforce today. And it's also been the case for working class women that they have always been involved in paid labour. But still, those stereotypes that are about, you know, the women's actual natural role is as the, you know, family mother and caregiver and so on persist. And this has actually led to most women having to take on a double burden in capitalism as both workers and primary caregivers in the home. At the same time, all of the stereotypes and ideological conceptions of women that are spawned by the family, that women are uniquely fitted to do this work, reinforce the ability of the bosses to underpay women workers. So if we just take into account women workers, taking into account women in full-time work as well as casual and part-time women, women still only earn a piddling 66% of men's male counterparts' wages. So we can see how, again, it's not just a case that women are subject to sexist attitudes in society, but these attitudes are structured into that society with material benefit to the exploiters and actual material, setbacks for women. And this sexism also flows through to the types of work that women workers are concentrated in, because women actually make up the majority of casual employees, 45% to about 14% of men. And under the cover of rhetoric about, you know, family values and women need flexibility in their work or whatever, it means that women, it means that the benefit to the employers is pretty clear. They say, oh, well, women benefit from this casualisation of work, and they can get away with denying a significant portion of the workforce conditions and benefits, and have actually paved the way for casualisation for whole industries and so on out of this. And it's also the case that workers in women-dominated industries, like teaching and nursing, which are associated as well with the expected gender roles of women under capitalism, have been subject to worse pay, and that's still the case today. So although capitalism has changed over time, this hasn't done away with sexism. It's just changed the way in which we experience it. And the double burden is just one example of it. With regards to sexuality, for instance, gone are the constraints of the 1950s, you know, where women were just expected to be chaste and cover up, save themselves for marriage or whatever. But those standards have been replaced by the expectation that women will be sexual beings who should be sexually available to men and attractive to men. And, you know, it's still the case that what women think about this is, you know, secondary. And that women who are sexually confident, on the other hand, or, you know, do have sexual lives that they're confident to assert, are labelled sluts, you know, they're too promiscuous, they go and court their fortune when they get raped or whatever, which is really, that's a bloody scandalous sexist idea that is really common in society today. The standards and stereotypes about women are reinforced in the media and advertised, in advertising, and we're socialised into them through our interactions with the family. And so they pervade every aspect of women's lives, including the ways in which men and women interact with each other and, you know, the ideas that surround that. So I wanted to use this example because I think it's very telling. A study that was released last year, actually, and it was done by a university professor in Monash. It was based on interviews with managers from Australia's top 13 companies. It showed that male executives are always more likely to hire men. And it's because these executives think that men are more likely to exhibit leadership qualities. And they consistently stated, in the report's words, that the perceived reluctance of women interviewees to enter into a game of aggressive personal politics in the workplace showed weakness and a lack of ambition for women, which in turn made them less employable. But in another indication of how the double standards flow through, women who were confident in their interviews and, you know, had clearly led in their careers and so on, were the male interviewees said, these women encourage suspicion and derision. You can't trust them. So, you know, it seems that women just can't win, really. But the key thing is that sexist attitudes like these don't just materialise out of the ether. They're underpinned by the fact that women are unequal in capitalism, that we're paid lower wages, subject to worse conditions at work, and treated as less serious. So it's not surprising then when both men and women take up these ideas and act as if they're not equals of men. And this is similar to how racist ideas become accepted, because they can seem to accord with the reality of our lives in this system. So today, because of racism, Aboriginal people are overrepresented in jail and they do live in substandard conditions in remote communities and so on. So the ideas that ideologues push, that blacks are backwards, require saving from themselves or whatever, you know, are criminalised, can seem to accord to a reality. And a recent report from WA, which was actually done on Indigenous housing, found that because Indigenous housing, when it exists, is purposefully built by the government with substandard materials, for instance, non-termite-resistant wood, when it falls apart, that gives the government a, you know, great opportunity to go on about, well, actually, look at these Indigenous people. They won't look after their homes. They're incapable of providing, you know, for their children's safety and welfare. So oppression helps to create a set of facts that then helps reinforce bigoted attitudes in society. Workers may take up these ideas, but we know where they actually come from. And the gender roles created for women by capitalism and institutionalised by the family also slide into the last form of oppression that I'll have time to touch on briefly, which is homophobia. Because maintaining the ideal of the nuclear family also requires demonising any kind of sexual or social relationship outside of heterosexuality. And the family, I think, is an example of how actually capitalism tries to get workers to regulate these stereotypes and impose them on each other as well. Because actually it relies on the ideal of the family to indoctrinate people with these same roles and behaviours. And it's actually incredibly effective because most of the time the people who are telling you or, you know, socialising you into those roles are the people who you're closest to, you know, your family members, your parents or whatever. Sorry to look over at my parents as I thought. But again, just as with sexism, homophobic ideas are reinforced by individuals, by people's everyday experience of life under capitalism. So this is an experience where heterosexual relationships are glorified on TV, where images of homosexuality are consciously kept out of schools. So therefore, heterosexuality is normalised and children actually can feel at ease to slag off about gay families or whatever because this does seem more out of the ordinary. It's not, you know, normal. It's something strange or whatever. The benefits of sexism and homophobia for the capitalist class are not just reducible to the unpaid labour in the home or the drag sexism creates on wages because oppression is also about social control. Homophobia and sexism hold workers back. Gender stereotypes undermine women and make us feel more underconfident. And if people don't feel as if we can have control over the most intimate parts of our lives, who we can sleep with, you know, who we can marry, who the government tells us we have a legitimate relationship with or whatever, this just makes it harder for people to see how we can fight for a better state of affairs in any area of our lives. At work, you know, how could we challenge something as big and alien to ordinary people as war or whatever? And I've spent most of my talk then, I guess, really trying to draw out how oppression is structured into capitalism for the direct benefit of the ruling class. But I want to finish on why this is so important for us to understand it. Because on one hand, we oppose oppression. And so, you know, it can seem like, well, don't we just have to fight it, you know? And we do. We want to fight oppression wherever it rears its head. Socialist Alternative doesn't just put up with homophobic laws or homophobic attitudes. We campaign against the homophobic ban on same-sex marriage, but actually, you know, if we don't condone people using, you know, a homophobic language or, you know, homophobic behaviour just because it's common or we understand where it comes from in society. One example of that is that, you know, when a bigoted teacher attacked one of our members at high school for putting up pro-gay marriage posters, we didn't say, oh, that teacher's ideas just come from the structure of capitalism, so, you know, we can't blame the individual. No, we campaigned against this person and their ideas and so on. But if you know where the ideas come from, and this is, I think, the critical part for socialists, is we actually know how best to combat them within the working class. Because oppression is a necessary built-in part of capitalism, we're not going to be free of racism or sexism or homophobia until we get rid of that system of class rule. But so long as workers do actually accept oppressive ideas and allow bosses to divide us, then we won't actually be able, we'll be hindered from building the kind of movement that is large enough or united enough to actually be able to get rid of this system, the kind of revolutionary movement that we need. And, you know, it's because these ideas actually undermine all workers' struggles, far short of revolution, and are of no material benefit for us, that we know that they can be overcome and that when workers actually fight back, they can have their backwards ideas challenged. And we can see how this plays out if we return for a moment to the example of the Ford factory that I raised earlier. Because actually the bosses there did play on the backwards ideas of workers to foster division in the workplace. But in 1982, a strike occurred there. And what happened? Well, many workers assumed that their Vietnamese co-workers, which were, you know, some of the most newly arrived immigrants, would scab on the strike. And their bosses actually saw the opening for this and tried to convince the Vietnamese workers to stay at work and so on, to exploit this. But the material fact that the rest of the workforce actually needed to win the Vietnamese workers to solidarity with the strike, to come out with them if the strike was going to be successful, actually had a logic to it. They needed to win arguments with the Vietnamese workers about why they should support the strike. And a leaflet was produced in Vietnamese, so actually in the language that these workers could understand, explaining the reason for the strike and appealing for their support. And the result was actually the Vietnamese workers were the last section of the workplace to agree to go back to work because they had been convinced. And after all, you know, they wanted a pay rise just as well as their other co-workers, so why wouldn't they support that? And out of this process, actually lots of workers had their racist ideas challenged and were taken aback by the resilience of the Vietnamese workers to actually fight back. So, you know, that was the logic of struggle. But it can't just be the case that we just hope that workers will spontaneously come to these ideas themselves. Because although the logic of working class struggle and the need for solidarity and unity pushes in the direction of challenging oppression, it's also true that the ruling class have a massive apparatus at their disposal for reinforcing these divisions. And these toxic backwards ideas can get a hold precisely because of what I said, that they can accord to a reality of inequality in our society. And because we're socialised into them from birth. In the case of the Ford factory strike, it was actually socialists who argued for the tactic of actually translating the leaflet so that workers there could build solidarity with the Vietnamese workers as a tactic that could actually help the strikers win. And I would argue, and the thing that I want to end on, is that we're in sore need of an organisation like that today that can actually lead the charge to build solidarity and win workers away from the ideas which hold us all back by arguing in every situation and in every workplace for solidarity to help, you know, educate our side on the history and dynamic of class struggle, and more than that, for drawing the connections between workers' rights, gay rights, and fighting for against racism in a way that can actually counter the way the ruling class tries to put all of these ideas together, pull those threads together to defeat us. And that's the kind of organisation that I've been very glad to participate in for the last number of years, and I really hope that people get a sense that that's the kind of organisation that we need to challenge oppression in society today and hopefully join.